sustaining our environment has been a recurring key concept for 21st century scientists and societies. During the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw just how impactful human involvement is in the natural environment.
Following the end of the lockdown, there were numerous videos surfacing the internet of wild animals roaming human parks freely, or animals who tend to remain in hiding, showing themselves out in the open.
The pandemic has changed the views of many, but for some, sustainability has always been on their mind.
In today's episode, we spoke to Neil Brigden, an associate professor at Mount Royal University who had written several research papers on consumer decision dynamics. I had the time to talk with him about how our decisions, may it be small or big, affect the environment.
So for my first question, what is the importance of our decision-making process towards a more sustainable environment?
That's a really big question. I mean, I think, you know, I can only really speak from my own perspective as a consumer and a marketing professor, but I think about sustainability a lot when I'm making my own consumption and purchase decisions, but it's very challenging to try to live more sustainably because it's quite difficult to trace the origins and practices that were involved in producing the goods that you might be interested in purchasing. And I think that complexity discourages a lot of people from really probing or analyzing those decisions. So we end up just throwing up our hands and saying, like, well, you know, there's sustainability issues around the production of any product, and I can't figure out which is the most sustainable thing I could buy, so I'm just going to pick the thing I want most.
All right, and what are some factors that contribute to one's decision?
I mean, I think we rely on a lot on the information that's put in front of us by the producers of products and services. And of course, there's a lot of concern in marketing about greenwashing practices, where companies want it to appear at least that their products are sustainably produced. But whether that's truly the case is often more complicated. It's not always as rosy a picture as the company might try to present. And then I think we're also influenced a lot by each other. So I think it's really important to have conversations about sustainability and to share information that you might have access to. If you learn something about, positive or negative, about a particular company or a particular product, then sharing that information, I think, can really help other consumers with their decisions.
All right. How does familiarity play a role in our decisions?
Wow. So a lot of our consumption is habitual. So we end up buying and consuming the same products again and again. And often with those habitual purchases and consumption behaviors, we're not really carefully unpacking them or thinking about them every time it happens, right? Like, I've found a kind of toothpaste that I'm happy enough with, and so every time I go to the store, I just reach for that same kind of toothpaste, and I'm not really worried about whether or not I'm not unpacking the sustainability of that particular product anymore. Maybe there was a time when I considered that, but those repeat purchases, those habitual behaviors, really don't get analyzed in the same way that a new purchase would, something different, something unfamiliar.
And what do you think are some challenges that holds us back in terms of adopting a more sustainable lifestyle?
I mean, I still think the biggest one is that difficulty in unpacking and understanding the way a product was made, where the materials were sourced from, the labor practices. There's a lot of complexity there. And in a lot of cases, we don't have the information, or we don't have the time to research every single purchase we might be making. And so I think that really holds us back. And then also, I just think that we don't always have great options available, right? So, you know, I'm not going to drive to another city or something to get to a different grocery store, because that's not practical for me, even if they have more sustainable options. And then I also think that a lot of the pressure to work towards greater sustainability has been put on consumers. And I don't know that that's fair or reasonable, that in a lot of cases it's the organizations, the companies that make things that have a lot of the power in that relationship that could make more meaningful changes rather than every individual consumer trying to figure these things out independently.
And in your own opinion, how can we promote sustainable consumption?
I think that when I have conversations about sustainability, something that really holds people back is their perception that it's a lost cause, that, you know, the climate is already warming, there's already all this pollution and stuff in the atmosphere, we're already creating garbage, and so there's a perception that our individual decisions don't matter. And so I think it's really important that we motivate people and communicate to them that their choices do matter, and that regardless of the current state of the world, if we all just if none of us are trying, then we never get anywhere. And so you have to do your part, do your share, and encourage others to do the same.
And for my final question, what are some other practices outside of sustainable consumption that can help future business leaders to make society more sustainable?
So I would think also of the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, which include a much broader conception of sustainability, including things like zero hunger and social equality. And I think those other areas provide a lot of opportunity for leaders and organizations to work towards a more sustainable future through their employment practices, through the charitable work that they might do, through the structure of their organizations, and you know, thinking at that deeper level about how creating greater equality and opportunity for all really moves us towards a more sustainable future.
All right, thank you so much.
We also spoke with Joe Pavelka, a health and physical education professor at Mount Royal University who has been teaching in the university's ecotourism and outdoor leadership program for over two decades. He spoke to us about the factors causing mass tourism and explained how we can combat it through ecotourism. So what inspired you to learn about sustainable tourism?
I guess my own travels, my interest in the outdoors, and my interest in sustaining the outdoors.
How has sustainable tourism shaped your career?
Well, probably in many ways, but I am a sustainable tourism professor, so it has allowed me to work in the outdoors, to do research in the outdoors, and the research that I do is really about the human interface with the outdoors. So I am what you would call a social scientist as opposed to a biological or ecological scientist. So I really focus on the human interaction with nature and the outdoors.
What is the biggest difference between ecotourism and tourism that a lot of people don't know about?
So, you know, we would really frame it in terms of mass tourism and then forms of alternative tourism, and ecotourism would be one of them. And mass tourism is very, very popular, and it really involves a lot of international ownership. So when you go to an all-inclusive in Mexico, that's probably owned by a very large company that has nothing to do with Mexico. The money does not stay in Mexico. We have a lot of people going to the same place at the same time. And there are a lot of social and often environmental impacts.
How has ecotourism changed from when you first started teaching in the 2000s?
Wow. So I would say ecotourism was very new in the 1990s and early 2000s, but it hasn't really changed that much. So, like, it's, you know, it's based on these very basic tenets of sustainability and local ownership. So we really focus on giving local people control over the benefits of the tourism and the scale of the tourism, how big it is, and those elements have not changed much over 30 years. there's a new term now called regenerative travel, and that tries to take it one step farther. Whereas ecotourism is about sustainability, regenerative travel posits itself to be about regrowing and making things better. And that's a great idea, and we'll see how far that goes.
So now we're going to move on to field school, your field school experiences. And so you've led a few field schools for MRU students to learn about ecotourism firsthand. What do the field schools teach students about ecotourism in large parks?
My students get to see the social element of sustainable tourism. So who lives there and how these people are actually impacted. And especially when you go into the global south, when you go into South America and parts of the Caribbean and Central America, it's quite a different world than it is in Canada. We have a lot of protections here and we have a very strong governmental structure, whereas you go to some places around the world and it's more of a cowboy kind of setting, Wild West kind of setting, and local people have a very important role in it. So what we do is we go down and we stay with the people in the various villages in the Amazon, up in the Andes, all over the place, and you see how they live with it and how they manage it. And I think that that is a great eye-opener for a lot of our students.
What would you say are some of the causes of overcrowded tourism in large parks?
Fear. No, some people run away from crowds and some people run to crowds. And the way that I am framing it these days is that social media gives us a lot of FOMO, and we're very worried about not making the right decision. And if you don't know a lot about parks, you're going to pick the park that is really busy because that's going to give you the confidence that you are picking a good park.
When would you say the spike in tourism began in Parks for Canada?
In Parks for Canada, I think it really began in around 2015, 2017, around then. Parks Canada had a free summer in 2017 where they relaxed all their fees, and attendance went up, and it has been pretty high ever since, although 2017 was the peak in Canada, but it has been very high post-pandemic, very high. Mm-hmm. So we are dealing with some very high numbers, but the bottom line is this. Most of our visitation goes to the top 10 parks. We have, 38 parks in Canada, and a lot of parks get very, very, very few people. So again, it's that clustering around branded parks that is really the issue.
And what would you say are those main kind of parks that people lean towards going?
Banff, Jasper, Pacific Rim, a bunch of parks in Ontario and in Quebec. But really, the four mountain parks, which is Banff, Jasper, Kootenay, Yoho, and then Pacific Rim, they account for a very substantial proportion of all Parks Canada visitation.
In what ways does overcrowding harm the health of the environment and the natural wildlife?
Well, it doesn't have to. So if crowds are managed well, then they are going to stay in the human areas and they will have little to no impact on the vegetation and wildlife. If they're not managed well, then there's a good chance that they will go off trail. They will drive in places where they're not supposed to, and then they'll hurt the vegetation, or they'll stop and feed bears along the highway. They'll do all sorts of things, but it doesn't really have to be that way. They can be managed better.
What has been the biggest challenge you have faced regarding sustainability and ecotourism?
I think, the way that I look at it is like this, right? There's three ways to get people to be more sustainable. One is education, two is policy, and three is structure. Build them a train or something so that they don't have to drive. What we have learned over many years is that education is probably the weakest way. When we ask people to do things better, that's probably the weakest way, because people are very geared towards self-interest. Policies don't often work. And what we need to be doing is we need to be doing more structural measures. If there are too many cars in Banff, let's build a train.
How can we implement ecotourism as non-locals when visiting parks?
you could just be more cognizant of where you are and what you are doing. And you can ask, most of this would be done ahead of time when you're planning your trip and you spend more time in areas that you have researched that you believe are sustainable as opposed to places that are not. So I would really say, you know, there's a lot of elements to it, but it really resides in your pre-planning. Once you're there, there's not much you can do.
And my last question for you is, how do you think ecotourism will change in the future?
I think ecotourism is going to be more popular and better accepted. It's already quite strong now. But I think it's going to grow, and I think it's going to grow mostly on that social side. And the social side is going to be that people don't want to see overcrowding, and they want to see spaces in a pristine manner. And as opposed to people who are speaking up for the environment. I'm a cynical guy. I think that people take care of people first. There you go.
Thank you so much, Joe.
We often hear people say that we should live life to the fullest because we only have one life to live. But we could also say the same thing about our home planet.
The land that this episode was recorded on is located on the Blackfoot, the Stoney Nakoda, and the Tsuut'ina Nations. We acknowledge that we are hosted in this ancient place by these people and by the Métis Nation Region 3. We value the land and the beings that are part of their ancestral world, and we pledge to do our work in a way that is respectful of their traditions. We hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as we did. I'm Sadaf.
And I'm Ralph. And this is the Eco Files, conversations from the MRU Sustainability Forum.